Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
New Books in Southeast Asian Studies is sponsored by the ANU Southeast Asia Institute, the Griffith Asia Institute, the New York Southeast Asia Network, the Nordic Institute of Asian Studies, and the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre.
Over 3 years have passed since the February 2021 military coup in Myanmar, in which a popular uprising was followed by a revolutionary situation. While researchers and writers have cobbled together edited books trying to come to terms with all that has happened since and how we interpret those events in relation to the country's recent past, we've had to wait a while for the first authoritative monographic treatment in English of events there. That monograph, published in 2023 by Stanford University Press, is Rights Refused: Grassroots Activism and State Violence in Myanmar. Its author, Elliot Prassi Freeman, spent the 2010s living and working with Myanmar activists. And then, as his research was approaching what he had thought would be its conclusion, it spilled over into further digital ethnographic work done since the coup. But it's not just the combination of extensive fieldwork during the last decade, supplemented by a whole lot more data generation in the time of revolution, that makes Rights Refused a landmark study in the politics and society of Myanmar. It's also, as Mark Goodale writes in its foreword, because this is a book that is noteworthy for its ambition, both intellectual and political. Its synthesis of debates, theories, and methodology from across a range of disciplines, its movements across multiple registers, scales, and temporalities. If all that sounds like it makes this a demanding book, then to be sure it is, but also a rewarding one, as we expect that this episode of New Books in Southeast Asian Studies will be. These days, Elliot Prassi Freeman is an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at the National University of Singapore, from where he's speaking to me, Nick Cheesman, director of the Myanmar Research Center at the Australian National University. Elliot, welcome and thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me. And as long as we're talking about genealogies, it's great to be talking with you, whose work I've, of course, followed for a long time and I see myself in conversation with in this book.
Well, thank you very much for saying so, and I look forward to being in conversation with you now about the book as well. Elliot, as I've gestured in my opening remarks to the time and place in which you researched and wrote the book, I think before we do anything else, it's important that listeners travel there with you. Would you please fill them in on some of the details I've skipped over for listeners who aren't very familiar with the last decade prior to the coup? Remind us of that time, how things were in the 2010s when you were doing your research, and then bring us up to date with what's happened since.
Yeah, I'll go back even a little bit farther. I first went to Myanmar in 2004, and so I was able to see some of the pre-transition era. And so unfortunately, what we have now returned to currently is not so foreign to what many Burmese people have experienced and what I got a chance to see. And when I first went there, I was surprised that some of the things I had read in popular literature and academic literature didn't really reflect what I saw on the ground. I kind of expected this big, scary state with men with guns everywhere and a sort of panoptic Foucauldian style power that seeped into every capillary of people's everyday lives. And it's not to say there was no state. It definitely was there when it wanted to pursue and repress certain things that it found to be a threat. But on the day-to-day life, I didn't see it that much. And I thought that was a really compelling intellectual puzzle that stuck with me even when I was not formally in academia. And when I went back to do a PhD, and the situation had changed quite a bit, I still kept that kind of in mind, as I was lucky enough to fall in with a group of activists who were very much opposed to some of the promises of the transition period, the liberalism of markets and some of the political freedoms. They still saw beneath that a bedrock of that same sort of elusive but brutal state. And so I was able to follow them around the country, much like a movable feast, in which I got to see many different kinds of struggles. And they felt like they needed to do that because there were so many struggles that were going on in the country. And they were kind of on this like continually peripatetic movement around lowland Burma. And I want to be clear that this is very much a lowland study. It doesn't, you know, doesn't climb hills. And so some of the political ontologies and idioms might not resonate with people who are in some of the other states. But that said, I did get to see them work on land struggles, which are incredibly potent during the transition period, because people were told explicitly or otherwise that a new day had come and they could get their land back. And yet some people even had more land stolen during this particular era. And so the activist who I work with, who took many different names, and it was less important what they called themselves than how they narrated their personal struggles sometimes, but I call them CDI, the Community Development Initiative. And they also were a part of a group called Movement for Democracy Current Force, which is a more militant version. They felt that this transition was actually making things worse for people. So they wanted to mobilize and organize communities both in the paddy fields, but also in peri-urban areas of Yangon, where they lived, and then in industrial zones, both in Yangon and in Mandalay, and even Chausse and Mandalay region, to try to struggle and achieve a better life for themselves. And so the book follows them around and kind of makes the transition a little bit legible. But by doing so, it also allows the coup that came after to make some sense. Because I think many of us were still flabbergasted at the choices by the generals to have a coup. And I don't at all claim to explain their choices, but I do try to make the state formation and the state consolidation project that was occurring and how this sort of larger apparatus functions. I was trying, through the way the activists worked and engaged with this apparatus, try to make it come into focus. And that therefore helps us understand the coup. But one last little point here, because the coup did happen, I couldn't just make the book about the transition. And while the coup put the final nail in the coffin of that transition, the revolution that emerged from February 2021 and still rages today was something that needed to be discussed. And so I tried to weave into every chapter the activists' current and ongoing struggles that they are pursuing even today. And so while the book ends in a sort of weird place, it reflects very nicely the activist's own perspective on things, which is that activism in a place like Myanmar never really ends anyway. So even though it ends in the middle of the revolution, it's a little bit more appropriate than what it would have been before, with this transition kind of stumbling along.
And I think that's one of the really attractive things about the book that I was suggesting in the introductory remarks, that you really have done a great deal of work to draw together the observations that you were making about this activism in the 2010s with events subsequently. You said that you fell in with these folks. Tell us a bit more about how that happened and about why they were willing to allow you to take along.
So I think any anthropologist who, if you catch them in a moment of honesty, will tell you that most of what they're doing is basically just based on luck. And mine is definitely that to a T. So I was in Yangon to work with a legal aid firm to try to figure out how people were struggling to get their land back. And that legal aid firm, almost immediately after I got to Yangon, fell apart. So I was all dressed up with nowhere to go and looking for a project. And I tagged along with a colleague who was working for a human rights organization documenting the ongoing land grabs, particularly in an industrial zone called Myota, which is outside of Mandalay. And that's when I first met Gotol, who's the most important protagonist and through which much of the material is refracted and made sense of. And this is when I was trying at this point to make sense of the liberalization and what exactly is Movement for Democracy Current Force. What exactly is that? Is it an NGO or is it a political party? And he looked at me kind of trying to assess whether I was a serious person or not. And he said, "We are a force." And I immediately laughed. And luckily, because he's a lovely person, he did too. I think that was an important commentary on the transition and what he saw as his group's place in it, that he didn't want to be captured by the sort of log frames, the silos of project management on one hand, or the sort of representational politics on the other. And that's when he introduced me to this wonderful Burmese phrase, yebo si, the idea of being the oil on top of the water. And he didn't want to be that. He accused other organizations of claiming to represent the people, but being, you know, gingwade, like separated from them. And his group really wanted to embed themselves with rural and industrial zone and peri-urban struggles to try to forge a different path for this particular moment. And not at all that they had predicted the coup, I don't think anyone did, but they saw that sort of potentiality and they did continue to kind of emphasize the fact that there can be no political future with the military involved. So why did they let me hang around is a great question. We kind of developed a sort of division of labor in which I would tag along and provide a little bit of cover for them because they would less likely be interdicted and beaten up if they had a person who looked like he might tell their story. But to be honest, I think it was less instrumental and it was more based on solidarity, however blurrily or poorly defined that term might be. I think they were, as many Burmese people are, really curious and happy when someone reflects that curiosity back. And as long as I wasn't, you know, screwing things up for them, and I always made sure, like, is it okay if I come? Is this one, should I sit this one out? But we always ended up pushing on an open door. We always were expecting the men with the guns to come out of the woodwork, or the MI officials. And sometimes they did. And at that point, what I was always assuming would escalate into something where my visa would be revoked. Instead, it was just like, please leave. You know, at one time we went to a prison to visit a comrade who had been in prison and bring him snacks and support. And I was like, can I actually do this? Can I go in here? And the guard looked at me with a look of not quite indifference, but kind of the look of, I don't want to get involved in this. This is beyond my pay grade. And I think the activists took advantage of that a lot, whether with me or without me. They would try to intimidate local level officials into maybe passing the buck up. And in that moment of people trying to figure stuff out, they would do what they needed to do to then evaporate away before they got in trouble. Because as they said, you know, there are times to get arrested and go to prison. And there are times when this is not the appropriate time for us to do so. So there, in this cat and mouse game, I got to like tag along, although they had a credible amount of endurance. They were almost like this, as I said earlier, sort of like continual oscillation between all these particular struggles. And that's because it was very difficult to ever interpret a failure as forever, because you could always re-signify it and turn it into an initiatory stage in another struggle. But this cuts the other way too. Almost every victory was never really securable. So I remember one time in Matia, which is up in Mandalay, this group had conducted a plow protest, which is a wonderful form of direct action. And I think I quote David Graeber, who talks about direct action as acting as if one is already free. Why would you need to protest over land that is yours? The farmers just took back their land and started to plant it. And only if they were interdicted by the police would they immediately switch into a protest register. And in this case, the police came by and said, quickly finish this up, don't make a scene, which I thought was a wonderful reflection of this weird, evasive sovereignty that you could observe in Myanmar. Sometimes it wasn't really all that there. And sometimes it was not really capturable, but it wasn't necessarily working against you either. So I came back, you know, 9 months later, and they had reaped what they had sown. They had planted seed. It had grown into paddy. They had harvested it. And I thought, oh, Ong Bi, victory has been achieved. And they said, well, we're not really sure, because they could always come back next week. You know, we have to remain vigilant, essentially. And in the years that have passed, that has indeed been the case, in which they have sometimes explicitly fighting with the cronies who try to steal their land and sometimes not. So to come back to the point, the activists had to kind of continually oscillate around these different struggles to try to resecure them. And gosh, that's an exhausting life. And I didn't have the endurance for that. So I would retreat back to Yangon and they would go do the certain things that they needed to do, sometimes without me. And then I would get back on the ride when it was appropriate for me to do so.
You're leading us into the two terms that are the book's title, our rights and refusal. And based on what you've just said about the plowing protests or plowing struggles or battles, depending on how you translate the term, we might think about this as a form of resistance, and yet you juxtapose the notion of resistance with refusal, and you distinguish strategies of refusal with tactics of resistance. So could you spell out that distinction and why it matters for you, and perhaps develop it further?
I found, because of this excessive sovereign power, that resistance was often a sort of pyrrhic or self-sacrificial strategy that wasn't very efficacious. And the activists were sometimes disdainful of the people who ran metaphorically or literally straight into the bayonets. I remember one time a character I called Durain was talking about one of their leaders who kept getting arrested. And Durain said, "This is not what a true leader does. A true leader knows when it's time to evade." And there's a part in the book where Hong Wenong, who's one of the leaders of the Lepidown protest, is very frustrated because everyone's calling him an opportunist or the black hand behind the curtain. And he wants to show himself to demonstrate that he's standing with the people. And his comrades have to convince him, this isn't your time to get arrested. Resist the urge to put yourself up front, which is an interesting way of thinking about the macho activism register, which sometimes these men and women would endorse and would enact. And so I started to think about how classic resistance models were a little bit lacking, because they tend to presume a stable class who is being oppressed and who's kind of ready to be called. And, one of the people I've learned from, James C. Scott, has this description of something he calls infrapolitics, the idea that the weak have a sort of hidden transcript that they're always already aware of. And so when the time changes, when the political opportunity structure changes, perhaps they can immediately, at like wildfire, spread through them and mobilize themselves. And I didn't think this was really the case, because I've been a victim of false consciousness before in my life. And I know how difficult it is to make sense of one's material conditions and read them politically. And I think Burmese people are the same. They've been not quite hoodwinked or mystified into thinking that the conditions they live with are natural, but they certainly are not encouraged to see them as politically intervenable, if that's a word. And that's a lot of the work the activists were doing, is to try to organize and build that consciousness. I think also resistance tends to presume a stable, legible object to protest against. And that's where I get into this description of the state being pretty darn slippery. It's hard to find it. And then when it does emerge, it's pretty darn violent. And so it makes more sense to refuse that sort of direct encounter. And then in that turning away, to not completely abdicate space, because that's no different than endorsing like pacification. And so I tried to, in other words, figure out a way to make sense of what these folks were up to that didn't endorse a sort of straight into the bayonets resistance model, but didn't do what I think some other literature has done, which is endorse a sort of, if I keep resistance in my heart, then that is doing something. Because these activists tended to stress the importance of continually making, in the semiotic terms I use in the book, signs that signify things to people, to use a sort of schematic metaphor, horizontally. They're trying to mobilize people. And if in that penumbra of refusal, they're not doing anything, then it's no different really than pacification. So they're constantly in that moment of turning away, then doing all these other things of organizing, building consciousness, imagining a different future. But there were moments of direct resistance that were necessary to try to presence that state, to try to create these sort of public spectacles that could suggest to people that things could be done otherwise, and even try to get some of those state agents to see things differently. So in the book, I talk about a sort of, dialectic between refusal and resistance, and how the two operate together, and it's more beneficial to see them that way than to necessarily choose between these models.
And the Lepidong mine, that would be an example of a site where resistance was an important part of that relation, perhaps to a greater extent than in other sites. Would you tell the listeners who aren't familiar with that mining operation why it's significant, not only to your story, but to a lot of the political narratives about land struggles in the 2010s?
Lebanon became like, it's a copper, well, it's not a copper mine. I mean, it wasn't a copper mine always. It was a place where farmers in central Burma outside of Munhwa were living. And for the last 30 years, it's been sporadically passed from one group to another as a potential copper mine that only turned into an active one in the at the very same moment that this transition was coming. So it became kind of an emblem of the contradictions of the transition, in which these farmers who were supposed to be benefiting ended up getting their land stolen, and what land they had left was being polluted by the runoff from this copper mine. And then when they protested against this and got some Buddhist monks to join the struggle, because this mountain also had religious significance, those monks were brutally beaten and there was white phosphorus used on them. And so it became this conflagration in more ways than one that many people in the country took as a sort of sign of the contradictions, as I said, of this moment. And Aung San Suu Kyi famously went there and tried to broker a deal, and the peasant women, in a video that circulated quite widely, chased her out of the village and said that she was, you know, making them, you know, she was dishonoring her father's name and those sorts of things by sacrificing them for this Chinese Myanmar military joint venture. And a bunch of activists who had also worked in other places supported this struggle and lived there for a really long time, Han Wen Ong being one of them, and a character I call So Ong, who is a big part of the book, were the ones who helped me get access to this place. And by the time I got there in 2016, it wasn't very much of an active protest place anymore. They still had a camp, but it was really at that point just kind of like hanging on. And it becomes an interesting part of the book because I struggled with trying to make sense of this thing that had gone on for so long, had become this emblem, had developed these really creative protest stylistics with mobilizing the occult realm and doing these things called Jainza Daipoe, which are cursing fights or cursing attacks. And they're important because they were taken on so much by the current revolution. So on that hand, they're indelible. But on the other hand, it was difficult to assess this as a victory. And I think while I struggle with that, the activists were less concerned about it. I mean, they certainly would have preferred to have been victorious, but I think they were more used to this kind of ambiguous outcome. You know, I was like, well, is it a victory? Is it a failure? And they're like, well, it's kind of both. And then, you know, and a lot of times they would say, you know, we will see. It was still always unfolding. And then to speak a little bit about those Jainza Daipoe, these were sort of cursing rituals that evoked and invoked quite literally a different sort of scale of justice. Because during this sort of moment in which, even during the liberalization period, and as you very well know, Nick, given your own long-term work on the legal system in Myanmar, this was not necessarily a system you could trust to bestow impartial justice. And so they would invoke this sort of cosmological realm, the spirits of the land, to come judge who was the rightful owner of it. And this was the part of the Jainza Daipoe, the cursing. Whoever was actually the one who had stolen it would be cursed to many or lifetimes of hell or very nasty karmic retribution. This was one of those things that they kind of stepped outside of what we might call like secular temporality and basically say, like, you could steal the land, but you might never get rid of the curse. Even with all the yadia, with all the protective magic that you bring to bear, it's quite possible that this will be bad for you in the future. And whether or not people believed this is a question I try to avoid, because I think most of the time people on the ground kind of avoided it too. It was this interesting situation of joint attention around this particular spectacle. It's like, I might not believe it, but you might believe it, or your wife might believe it, or your kids might believe it. And it becomes this sort of shameful thing that, I, as I argue in the book, tries to encourage the people who are doing nasty things to see things differently. I call this sort of like an interpolation from below to try to bring what we might call weapon of the week out into the open and encourage, rather than to yell directly at them, you know, you are going to hell, or you are a bad person, or give us the land back. Although they would say those kinds of things sometimes, they would also say, well, consider that this will get you into major trouble with your karma if you continue to pursue these paths. One of the things that was fascinating is when the coup emerged, so many of these Jainza Daipoe came up around the country. All across the country, people were tapping into this repertoire of contention and using it against the regime. And one might say, well, has that been successful? And again, we're still seeing this play out, so it's difficult to assess.
One of the striking things in that chapter of the book on the Jainza Daipoe is that you work through this notion of interpolation from the analysis of cartoons. I was reminded of Lisa Wadeen's work, Ambiguities of Domination in Syria, and wondering if that was partly an inspiration for your approach here. But why was it that you found cartoons a particularly useful site to do this work? And for listeners who have not yet had the opportunity to look at or read the book, how do you move from that analysis then to the account that you offer of James R. Dipoy as another form of interpolation?
Thank you for giving me that opportunity, because cartoons are a big part of my study of Myanmar, even my language learning. But I want to stress how important they are for literary culture and even just popular culture writ large in Myanmar. There were Facebook pages that would circulate political cartoons, dozens per day, with millions of people who were following these things, if Facebook followers is any indication. Political cartoons participated in a number of different, what we might call genres or registers, that demonstrate that they are much broader than the political cartoons that I was used to, at least, in which tended to be satirical. These could be hortatory, they could, you know, just be trying to make a political point in the sense of a picture is worth a thousand words. They could just be kind of encompassing or encapsulating what was going on in the news. And I would read these with Burmese colleagues thinking that I had missed something as a non-native speaker. And they would say, no, this one isn't funny. It's just meant to tell you what's going on. And then, of course, the ones that were satirical played on so many different wonderful innuendo and indirect speech, something that a colleague told me is like sampyo, the sort of like way of speaking indirectly. And I thought, well, this is a good way of thinking about how politics is done in a place like this. And there was a particular kind of cartoon that partakes in this form of indirect or interpolation from below, which came up so often in my so many different cartoonists that it really almost belonged to its own register. And this was what I call like the elite gets shocked register. And what would happen is that a character would be down on the street talking to his or her friend, and the elite, usually marked by a special headpiece or an attendant who was walking next to him, would hear it in a wrong way. Who would hear it in a way that applied to his own sense of shame about what he was doing. Now, of course, the cartoonist was able to stage this shame, and the real elite might not feel it. But what I thought was kind of interesting about this is that this wasn't the person on the ground yelling at the elite who managed to go down to their level. It was the elite himself, usually him, creating this new understanding by mishearing what was at the same time simultaneously the truth. And I thought, well, this is kind of what's going on in the cursing rituals too. They use this interesting broadcast register. They would say, whomever is responsible for this will go to 500 hells. It was often welcoming anyone who was potentially involved in these political situations to see themselves as hailed. And so it was inviting them, much like these elites in the cartoons, inviting them to see things a different way. We can ask like whether this was successful or not, but I thought it was an interesting way of thinking about how one has to do politics in a place where it's difficult to merely speak truth to power, as it were.
Elliot, I want to go back to something you said earlier, because from there we can go to what we haven't yet discussed, which is the master concept of the book. We've been talking about it indirectly, but I think we need to get to it, and I suggest now is the time to do it. You mentioned at one point that one of the reasons for this dialectic of refusal and resistance is that you said the state, but you've written that the sovereign power in Myanmar is slippery. What do you mean by that? And then there's an invitation there also to introduce to us blunt biopolitics, isn't there?
Yeah, so as I was talking about, this is a kind of state that can execute some of the most sovereign actions imaginable. It can conduct a coup, it can steal people's land, it can arrest and torture protesters, and it can conduct a genocide, which is something that I would like to get to at some point, because I do try to address one of these other huge and tragic events of Myanmar's recent history with the Rohingya expulsion of 2016 and 17. But at the same time, this was also a state that could kind of disappear from grasp. This was a kind of state that, as I said in Matia, would evaporate and say, you know, just finish things up quickly. I once went to a court compound where a number of protesters had just been convicted for 54 months for conducting a peaceful protest outside the Chinese embassy. And instead of, you know, merely meekly walking back to prison, one of the protesters took off her shawl and burned it and declared that victory had been achieved even as she was about to go to prison. I kind of had expected the riot police to come out, but instead, you know, she was allowed to do her thing. So there were all these moments when I expected a robust state presence and it didn't come. And this was a continual challenge for activists too. It's not just when they did their thing, but when they were trying to advocate for the farmers or the workers, they would ask the farmers, well, what have you done? And it's like, well, we've sent 12 letters and we've never heard anything. So there's a certain kind of madness that gets produced when you're trying to create an impact in the world and people are just ignoring you, refusing to let your sign signify, a major form of gaslighting, as it were. And so a lot of what the activists tried to do was to rewrite those letters to try to get the state to materialize, to make sure the correct people were copied, to make sure the press was involved if that was what would be necessary. And if there was still no response, then to escalate, to do a plow protest, etc. And so I was struggling with the slipperiness. And then I also was thinking about how the slipperiness isn't just in the sort of despotic or coercive apparatus of the state, but it was also in the more governmental or biopolitical part, the more regulative, if we can say that. So this is the kind of state that would have ID cards, but not really insist anyone carry them. It would have racial classifications, the famous 135 ethnicities, but not really know them, and to the extent that you have exonyms and endonyms on the same list, and the people on the ground laughing at the fact that of how they were registered. You had the Salon and Austronesian people classified as Bama, who are Tibeto-Burman. So a very mixed up classificatory system that sometimes was actually given over to the people themselves to remake. And what I mean by that is that a question in Burmese, like to ask someone what their race or ethnicity is, Balumyole, could be answered by people, and it was answered quite a few times by people who I talked to with answers that did not seem to conform to those classifications. So people would say, I'm Hindu Lumyo, or I'm Muslim Lumyo, or even I'm Buddhist Lumyo. And as an anthropologist, I'm fascinated by this, and I'm totally happy with people classifying however they want to. But what this indexed was the inability of the state to monopolize and exhaust the sort of even the classificatory systems that we tend to associate with high modernist states. People were able, and Mabata was a good example of this, which is a right-wing religious organization that kind of deputized itself to police intermarriage at a local level. They were able to foreground Buddhist identity astride some of the other ethnic identities. So I was trying to make sense of this state that on one hand could imagine people not as individual right holders, certainly, but through a biopolitical paradigm in which populations were taken as the object of governance. And this kind of emerges from Michel Foucault's work and then Partha Chatterjee, who's a philosopher and political theorist anthropologist at Columbia, who used this in the context of South Asia, especially to say with colonized people, when they weren't taken as individuals, but always taken as parts of populations, they tend to mobilize their politics through those population groups. And I was thinking about this in regards to Burma as being at least a little bit closer to what we were seeing than the sort of liberal model of individual rights holders. But then I was thinking, you know, one of the things that Chatterjee says is that he has this great book called The Politics of the Governed, and he says most of the world operates through these population groups rather than as individual rights holders. And I was wondering, well, are Burmese people even able to mobilize as population groups when those population groups are so poorly known and understood, perhaps even to themselves? And so one of the things that I thought was going on in some of the mobilization and refusal work by the activists was to get these folks to mobilize themselves as populations, to kind of travel, you know, if we use a spatial metaphor, from outside of the realm of political society into that realm that Partha Chatterjee talks about and that he presupposes exists. So to come back to biopolitics, sometimes in the Western European context, it's imagined as a paradigm of life promotion and protection. The idea being that the whole state or whole society, as it's imagined, flourishes by regulating the biological elements of the population and subpopulations too, some who get privileges and some who are, as Foucault said, let to die. And I thought, well, this seems to be something similar, but a little bit different. And outside of the Western European context that Foucault was writing about, maybe biopolitics gets refracted. Now, theorists like Achille Mbembe who talk about this in terms of necropolitics, but I thought that was a kind of an oscillation too far towards just pure death-making and excess. And while the Burmese state can do that, it's not all death all the time. And so I was trying to find a synthesis between these two poles, a biopolitics of life promotion and mere death making that certainly can exist. And so blunt biopolitics kind of comes out of that. And I define it in kind of like three ways that are different from the standard. So it still takes populations as a group to regulate, but it doesn't promote their life. It doesn't necessarily protect their life. It just takes their existence as an index of the general's own success and ability to rule. The second is that it doesn't know people very well in the way that, you know, standard biopolitics is imagined, that people are regulated and promoted and their lives are improved through statistical measurements that allow the state or whatever apparatus to tweak things, to increase the birth rate, decrease the death rate, those kinds of things. This is not a state that does that, but rather regulates through violence. And so this part is probably the most tendentious part of the theory. I'm okay with it not being the smoothest and the most well worked out at this point, because one of the things that we tend to think about in Foucauldian work is that violence of the sovereign variety tends to be the opposite of this regulative form that biopolitics stresses. But one of the things that I observed when working on the Rohingya issue was how violence ends up creating the very object that it's trying to destroy in certain contexts. And one of the ironies of mass violence is that it massifies the thing and creates new identities that perhaps weren't there before. And I want to be very careful here because I don't want to be understood as saying that the Rohingya didn't exist until they were an object of violence. I don't think that is substantiable from the ethnographic and ethnological record. These people have been there for a really long time, but there was a reason why they weren't necessarily calling themselves Rohingya. And it was pretty aggressively policed. It was a thing that could get you in trouble. There were lots of different ways that people identified. They had substantively ethnicity, but they weren't necessarily articulating it until they were targeted through the violence of 2012 through the 2017 expulsion. And I tracked in other work and mentioned in the book these Rohingya realization moments when people face this violence or observe violence being done to people who looked generally like them and realized that they were being taken as this object together and asked their parents, like, it's sometimes quite literally, like, who are these people and how do they relate to us? And their parents would say things like, well, we didn't want to tell you this, or it wasn't the appropriate time when you were younger, it was too dangerous, but we are those people too. And so one of the things I wanted to think through with violence, and this is one of the things I'm still thinking through, and I know it's one of the issues that you in your own work have been pursuing, is how to think about violence in its productive form, not merely a thing that tears things apart, but in so doing rebuilds new identities. And that was the sort of last part of the blunt biopolitics, a sort of state that rules through violence that ends up producing things as an outcome.
Thanks for that really thorough account of this important feature of the book. So I'm sure you've had some interesting discussions and pushback on blunt biopolitics, but I do think it's important at this point that we turn to the genocide and expulsion of the Rohingya. You're already bringing us to it, and perhaps to the reappraisals of those events after the 2021 coup among at least some members of the non-Rohingya community, and especially among members of the majority Burma. In talking about these events in the book, you introduce, rather, you engage with Sally Engelmary's notion of vernacularization of rights, and then you offer, I think, a provocative reading of her account, and then proceed to reinterpret it by negating it and talk about de-vernacularization. So can you explain what's going on there and then relate it to what you're doing in that chapter on the events of 2017 in particular?
Sure. And this will allow me also to segue into, I think, the unique ways that rights are discussed or understood in Burma as well. So Sally Engelmary was incredibly influential in her work. She recently passed away, unfortunately. In her vernacularization theory, she was considering the ways that universal ideas of human rights could be taken to different contexts and made legible to different societies. And one of the things that she was quite clear about, but I think sometimes misread by the people who followed in her footsteps, was how this was ultimately mildly colonizing. She was quite insistent that human rights had to have a universal valence. Otherwise, they wouldn't be worth vernacularizing. And so the vernacularization project always carried with it a sort of trace of trickery. It was basically trying to smuggle in or square the circle of a universal framework that didn't jive naturally with what was going on the ground. And she insisted that this was necessary because if it did jive perfectly, there would be no need for human rights in the first place. So it needed to make a difference. By teasing that out, I wanted to continue to focus on the political and contentious nature of human rights vernacularization projects, in which they're sometimes presented as merely liberatory or almost messianic, but they can create a reactionary reaction. And I think sometimes, and this gets into my obsession with temporality, at what point do we actually say that something is ever finished? Because in the case of vernacularization projects, they can be successful at a local or a circumscribed level, but they can create massive responses. And I think what happened in Myanmar is after Aung San Suu Kyi stopped endorsing human rights explicitly, they became easy to re-signify as a sort of Western colonial project and turned against the Rohingya who were mobilizing them. And the Rohingya, because they were so excluded from civil society and other social movements in the country, I argue, relied on rights because it was one of the few resources they had. They couldn't do politics very effectively in the country. And so they relied on these international human rights frameworks that seemed to be endorsed by the people they wanted to be in solidarity with. But then the context changed. Aung San Suu Kyi stopped talking about human rights and started talking about Nangantha Akwenye, or citizen rights, of which the Rohingya did not qualify. And suddenly they were reinterpreted, or perhaps they are always interpreted this way, but they were, the Rohingya, that is, were taken as taking opportunities or taking rights that didn't necessarily belong to them. And that allows me to talk a little bit about the interesting ways that rights are conceived of in Myanmar. So when I was first trying to understand politics in the country, I found that there were many people on the inside, this is back in 2009, 2010, before the transition, who are, you know, trying to mobilize the people and work for the sawat neye, the livelihoods of folks. Not talking about rights at all, but on the border, on the country where many exiles were, they were definitely talking about human rights paradigms. And at first, I thought, well, this is maybe interesting. Why are people talking so little about human rights in a place where they seem to be being violated? But, you know, as James Scott has long counseled us, when people are not able to freely say things, it's not very surprising that they might not endorse them loudly. And so I thought, well, okay, this isn't all that interesting. But then when I was doing the fieldwork on the border, I did talk to people who described the way their entire lives had changed by being exposed to human rights frameworks. And so I thought, well, maybe there's something interesting going on here if the people who are on the inside hadn't been exposed to these things. And then as I was struggling with this particular issue and asking friends and colleagues about it, someone in Yangon, who ran, a Burmese person who runs an NGO, had said, well, you have to understand something about our language. We don't have a conception of rights. She said, you know, for instance, if I invite you to go to a training, you can say, I have a right to go to that training. In English, you would say opportunity. No, but in Burmese, these two words are the same. And as a result, there's confusion about rights and we tend to not talk about it. So I, as an anthropology student who had been versed in the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis and the danger of taking language as determinative of culture, was very resistant to this at first, but I was intrigued. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't saying, well, you guys don't have this word rights, hence you can't have a conception of it. But I did want to entertain or at least think through what it would mean if these concepts that my linguistic and political history and ontology separate into two separate concepts are braided together. And I found that I was kind of kept my antenna up for the ways that people talked about the Burmese terms when I did my fieldwork, looking for cognates of the term akwenye and finding that sometimes lu akwenye would be human rights or alotama akwenye, worker rights. But then there are also terms like akwenye tama, which means opportunist. That root is definitely pointing in two directions. And so I was thinking, well, at what point will some people use this to mean rights and some people will use this to use opportunities? So I developed a huge corpus of all the different ways that people talk about it. And one of the things that I ended up the conclusion I came to was less about, you know, whether something is a right or an opportunity, although I do tend to think they are kind of braided together in Burmese, but what kind of possession they are. And I realized, or at least I argue in the book, that in the Western tradition, rights are talked about linguistically and imagined ontologically, if you will, in similar ways to like arms or mothers. If you sever your arm on the way to this podcast interview and it's laying there in the street, you would still talk about it as yours, even if in a meaningful sense, it's not anymore. It's been removed from your person. If your parent is deceased, you still use the possessive pronoun my to describe them. My mother is well, luckily. I'm very happy about that. And the same way we would talk about rights that way. And I think this comes up even when we don't have these things. So as the Beastie Boys remind us, you have to fight for your right to party. So even in the context in which you don't have the right, you can fight to get it back, which is an interesting paradox and something that only reveals itself as such when put into a different context in like in Burma, where I don't think, or at least I didn't find people using those terms in Burmese very often as possessing something, especially when it wasn't in their possession, right? It wasn't an inalienable possession, the thing that they could call their own when they didn't have it. So rights could be carried off. They could be stolen. Some people could get more rights than others. And hence Rohingya could come in as opportunists, cut the queue as it were, and snatch the rights that belong to the people who had suffered for even longer, which I don't endorse, of course, but this is the some of the interpretations that I observed and tried to reflect in the book. And so I then started to think, well, what does a politics that doesn't have rights to rely on, what does it enable and what does it prevent? And so on one hand, it makes politics a lot more difficult and a lot more necessarily improvisational because people can't point to their standing as a sort of third person. You know, the sort of, I am a citizen of the country and hence can do this because I'm an unmarked token of a common type, just like you are, just like that person is. Activists had to foreground their own personal struggles, sometimes pointing literally to their own bodies and saying, you know, this scar I got when I was in prison, when you were just a baby, there's nothing you can do to me that hasn't been done before. The kind of things that made the hair stand up on the back of my neck every time I heard them, so laced with affect and emotion. But at the same time, this reliance on one's own history tends to be potentially demobilizing for people who don't have those histories. And so it can cut both ways. While it forces people to be improvisational and it never get kind of stuck in thinking that they have rights that they don't have, it also prevents people from relying on a framework that could enable their politics. And so the book tries to think through what it might look like if we, in other places, especially in America, a place I know better than others, what could happen if we tried to give up on rights? And I think it's particularly difficult because of this inalienable rights framework, because to give up on rights would be to give up on something that's really part of our personhood, the same way our arms and our mothers are. And that's why it's so difficult. And that's why I think there's a sort of ennui or enervation in many American political movements, because people fight for their rights, but when they don't get them back, they're stuck in this sort of loop of being, you know, severed, I use that term again, from this person who they're supposed to be, but they can't actually realize in real life. And Burmese people, at least the activists I worked with, were never stuck in that sort of paradox, and they were never reliant on a framework they knew couldn't actually deliver justice for them.
If then this conception of rights is, as you put it, a semiotic or pragmatic rather than normative, what are the implications for responsibilities? Sort of often that are juxtaposed with rights. How does the discourse of responsibilities in Myanmar in the time that you were doing your research and perhaps since the coup, how is that informed by and inflected by this conception of rights that you've just outlined for us?
When you can't make a rights claim, there's no duty bearer to give it to you. And so that would seem on the face of it to dissolve the sort of rights responsibilities dialectic. But what one actually observes is that dawan or responsibility is a really fecund and potent term in the country, but not in the sort of sense that we might think. It's not one's duty that is always already presupposed, but one's duty is always imminent or potentially emergent. And so what I mean by that is that activists would often use dawan and responsibility as a sort of suggestion to the people who are in power to live up to the potential best versions of themselves. Doing one's duty is not necessarily merely fulfilling the obligations as written in a sort of contract, but it's a much more charismatic or proactive position in which people would step up and do the things because they are a kind of good ruler. And this fits into the sort of part I was talking about earlier, where it sometimes is not very effective to make explicit demands on people who don't see themselves as bearing any responsibility to you, but you can suggest that they fulfill duties that they take on themselves. So they would say things like, a good ruler would take this responsibility. Now, they would often find that that good ruler wasn't emergent. And so they would say, okay, it's actually our responsibility. We will take the responsibility is a phrase I heard every day when I talk to the activists. And as I still do on most days, I chat with them and with Gotol, and he's always talking about the responsibilities he was taking, which I'm trying to make sense of. And I think he's trying to create alternative versions of the political and politics in which people would take on the responsibilities for one another. And this fits into the sort of interesting position that the activists are trying to play vis-a-vis the people. On one hand, because they can't rely on rights and they can't tell the peasants and the workers that they're working with that you have rights and you can stand on your own 2 feet, they have to take the responsibility to stand in front of the people at the start. But they know they can't inhabit that position forever. It's not sustainable. It's just not very good politics either. And they often quote Aung San, the father of the country, according to many who once said that, you know, you have to be your own heroes. They play this sort of difficult and paradoxical game where they have to act like a hero. They have to take the responsibility for the people only to model what it would mean for them to take their own responsibility. And so, to be honest, it has ambiguous outcomes. Sometimes the people are able to inhabit those roles, but often they're kind of looking to the activists as patrons to defend them and are exposed to more risk by hitching their wagon to the activists. And I recall a time in Mandalay when a group had conducted a plow protest for which they had borrowed a lot of seed and hence it cost a lot of money. And then the military came back in, destroyed their fields and arrested them. These activists who were based in Mandalay, in a not particularly sensitive way, chided the villagers and reminded them, you know, you always knew this was possibly going to happen. And they kind of grumbled and said, yes, of course, you know, there was always long odds. And I got to talk to them later and I said, did you expect this to happen? They said, no, we expected to get our land back. And so it is a kind of dangerous game. And I don't want to present activism as merely sort of heroic and always having great outcomes. It's something that in a situation as brutal as Burma, it definitely doesn't always lead to the right things. But I do think that it is a compelling alternative, the way that they tried so hard to get people to see things differently and quote unquote be their own heroes.
Early on in the discussion, you said the book ends in a weird place. Given the intensity of the struggle, the revolutionary situation that's followed from the military coup in 2021, how did you decide to end it? And what have you been working on since?
It was hard to figure out where to end it, but the story that I had wanted to tell about how the activists who I worked with had made sense of the transition and had made sense of the revolution, I felt like I had done maybe not as much as I could do, but I had done something. Even in the preface, I talk about how it's difficult to end the book with the revolution still raging, but it has to end at a certain point and to make room for the history that is still unfolding, and especially the parts that I didn't get to talk about enough in the book. And so since 2018, I've been working more closely on the Rohingya genocide and conceptualization of themselves amidst mass violence and thinking about what it means to be Rohingya as people are spread across the diaspora, whether in Bangladesh or Malaysia or Thailand, places that I've been conducting field work since 2018. It's difficult to get to the camps these days. And of course, the camps are a pretty depressing place. And I want to stress that that's not necessarily how they were always seen. The first couple of years when I was able to go there, of course, like life in a refugee camp is miserable, but it was a misery tinged with hope, especially because people were able, and Mayu Ali, who's a Rohingya poet, has written about this, in the, I think in The Independent or The Guardian, about there was a sort of cultural revival that that occurred in the camps during that particular time, because people were not as explicitly repressed as they were in northern Rakhine State, especially since 2012. But a lot of internal Bangladeshi political reasons have led to a crackdown on that freedom in the camps. So I'm conducting a sort of oral history project with elderly people in the camps, working with a research team who I was lucky enough to collaborate with, that is trying to figure out what lifeways were like before the violence of 2012, before Nagamin in 1978, when some of the explicit kind of ethnic cleansings began. And this is a sort of dangerous project because it's always difficult to look back and describe things as they were, rather than through the idealized rose-tinted glasses of the antediluvian moment before the violence came. But I'm trying to tell a more complete story than what we tend to get with the Rohingya, which is kind of reduced them to suffering subjects who have withstood violence in a way that is completely uniform. And everyone is exactly the same. And these are people who don't really have much history or much ethnological distinction to themselves. And so I'm trying to figure out political economy, the clan-based or social relations, how marriage markets worked, how conflicts were resolved, where people moved and how they traveled in Rakhine State at that particular moment. Did they go abroad? So all these sort of like questions that one would hope would already exist, but hasn't actually been really written into the record. And as a result, the Rohingya tend to be talked about as these sort of victimized objects rather than people with their own stories to tell and their own life ways. And so with a sort of appropriate amount of, we might call, humility with such a big project, I'm trying to allow a lot of Rohingya voices to tell their many different stories in a book project that I'm working on now.
And Blunt Biopolitics, are you going to keep working on it, developing it theoretically, or do you think you'll leave it to others to pick it up and play with it?
I think I'm going to continue to think about it, especially by working more on violence and trying to think about what we mean when we talk about violence. I find this to be a term that, as it's kind of pullulated and come up in more and more places, structural violence and epistemic violence, violence is pretty much everywhere these days. And I think the more it's talked about, the less we actually know what we're saying. I know that's a thing that you've been interested in over the years. So the things that I've been reading about recently have been kind of along those lines, trying to dig into what people mean when they talk about violence.
So before we spoke, I invited you to name a couple of books that you're reading that you'd like to recommend to listeners. So what have you chosen for us?
So along those lines of talking about violence, I've been reading Elsa Dorland's book, Self-Defense, A Philosophy of Violence, which came out of Verso Books last year or the year before. It's interesting to think about self-defense, because whenever people want to distinguish between violent acts and ones that they think are just, they sometimes invoke these self-defense frameworks. And so violence dissolves when you say, well, it was self-defense anyway. And unfortunately, right now, with the carnage that's going on in Gaza, we see this violence being defended as a sort of quote-unquote right to self-defense. And so trying to think through that, and I found her book to be very challenging and provocative. I'm also reading Nefertiti Tadiar's book entitled Remaindered Life. It is about interesting distinctions that emerge in late liberal globalized society between those who are able to reproduce themselves and those who are essentially hired to be the kind of servile life who reproduces things. And it is an interesting sort of like global biopolitics, and it fits into that broader theme of Blunt Biopolitics. In terms of Burma, there's a lot of really interesting stuff that's going to be coming online in the next couple of years. Books by Jeff Ong and Courtney Whittakin, I'm really looking forward to. And closer to being published is Michael Edwards' book, Real Change, Myanmar and the Dissonance of Salvation, which is on Chin Pentecostalism within a very Buddhist Burma. And he has a wonderful ethnography that I'm excited for other people to get to read as well.
Thanks a lot for those suggestions. The Dorland book on self-defense I went and got as soon as I saw it was out. So I'm glad you've recommended that. And noting those forthcoming titles on Myanmar or Burma, it'd be remiss not to note that you've been doing tremendous work with the Burma Studies mail list and keeping an updated bibliography of new titles online. And we'll put a link not only to those books that you've recommended, links to those books, but also a link to the bibliography on the New Books website for people who haven't yet seen that. Eliot Prosser-Freeman, thanks a lot for taking the time to speak to me today about rights refused, grassroots activism, and state violence in Myanmar.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise. And listeners, if you found this episode interesting, then you may like to download or stream me talking with Jared McCarthy about his Outsourcing the Polity, Non-State Welfare, Inequality and Resistance in Myanmar, or a book that touches on topics that we've discussed in this episode but didn't speak about directly, Lynette Schuer, on her Politics of Love in Myanmar, LGBT Mobilization and Human Rights as a Way of Life. These are just two among the now approximately 23,000 episodes available for you to download from the New Books Network or listen to them wherever you get your podcasts.